Good morning, everyone. We begin this morning with the third session of our seminar entitled Searching for the Truth on Origins, where we continue to look at the facts regarding the creation-evolution controversy. The title of our topic in this particular session is called The Origin and the Progression of Life. And as with the origin of the universe, the origin of our planet Earth, we really have two choices. Either life originated by a process of chance, or it came into existence because of a supernatural creator designer. Now, in our last session, we looked at this subject of why the universe exists, why the solar system exists, and our planet. Now we want to get down to the basic point regarding the creation-evolution controversy, and that is, how did life come into existence on this planet? And again, we turn to some of the statements made by individuals who claim that evolution is the only credible worldview, claiming that science has proven that life has originated not because of a designer creator, but because of a natural process. For example, we can quote Isaac Asimov, former promoter of evolution, now deceased, who has made this statement in the past regarding the origin of life. We can make inspired guesses, but we don't know for certain what physical and chemical properties of the planet's crust, its ocean, and its atmosphere made it so conducive to such a sudden appearance of life. Nor are we certain about the amounts and the forms of energy that permeated the environment in the planet's early days. Thus, the problem that scientists face is how to explain the suddenness with which life appeared on planet Earth. Now, this is a rather significant statement. Asimov was willing to admit that the best that we could do regarding the subject of the origin of life is to make inspired guesses. But as we mentioned in our previous presentation, science must be based on fact, observable evidence, and repeatable experimentation. Certainly, there must be more than this in order to verify the idea that life has evolved. John Reeder, evolutionist, scientist, from the book The Rise of Life, page 9, regarding the origin of life, makes this statement. Once life began, its story becomes a logical, not to say inevitable, sequence of evolutionary cause and effect, which science is able to recount in fascinating detail. But just how life began is still something of a mystery, not incontrovertibly explained. The chemical constituents of organisms have been identified. The biochemical processes that keep organisms alive are known in complex detail. But the vital spark that initiates life awaits precise definition. Life, so obvious and simple a phenomenon, yet so hard to explain. Well, another interesting statement made by a scientist, evolutionist, and as you can see, there is no proof that life has originated from non-life by chance. Well, Raymond Hockey, scientist, evolutionist, in a book, Evolution, the Story of the Origins of Humankind, page 1, regarding the origin of life, states, after countless chance encounters between organic molecules, an event as miraculous as that which created the universe occurred in the depths of the seas. About 3,500 million years ago, groups of organic molecules came together to form living cells which all life was ultimately to descend. So, as we can see from these three statements, there's one common denominator, and that is the evolutionary worldview is based on the assumption that in the distant, unobservable past, non-life became life spontaneously, without a designer, without a creator. Well, all of us at one time or another have seen typical charts like this This one taken from a National Geographic, showing how life takes hold on an infant planet. And there on this mural, we see the sequence. On the left-hand bottom corner, we see lightning bolts striking the primitive pond. Then above that, we see the appearance of atoms forming molecules. And then these molecules become more complex. And then we see the appearance of a cell and then a multicellular creature. There's the sequence. That's how they say it happened. But is this proof? A number of years ago, in the late 80s, I had an opportunity to be involved in a documentary film called The Evolution Conspiracy. And we traveled around North America, in Canada, the United States, to major museums and universities. And we interviewed curators of museums and professors, asking them why they believed that evolution was true. One of the locations where we went was to the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. And we were interviewing the curator of the non-life to life portion of the museum. He was standing in front of a mural very much like the one that you're looking at here. And we asked him this simple question: how did life originate? And he attempted to answer. In fact, three times he attempted to answer, and each time he stuttered and stammered, and finally after the third attempt, he stopped, and he said, I can't formulate the words in order to make a proper presentation. He said, you'll have to find somebody else to do this. And he refused to continue. And we were unable to use anything that he had said. He wouldn't even sign the release. So as we were taking down the camera equipment, the curator of the Smithsonian Institute walked over to the cameraman and he started to chuckle. He said, I'm almost embarrassed, but I realized as I was attempting to answer this question that the whole idea of the origin of life is so speculative. I certainly don't want to be in this film representing the evolutionary position. Now that's amazing. Because over 6 million students are bused to the Smithsonian every year. And they see the same presentation. In fact, there's a little theater there. It's called the Chon Theater. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen are cartoon characters. And they do a little dance and join hands together, and poof, all of a sudden they become a cell. But cartoons and paintings do not prove that non-life can become life. No one has ever observed it. You see, a number of years ago, Emmanuel Reddy proved to the world that you can't get life from non-life spontaneously. At that time, people believed that if you put garbage outdoors, it would eventually turn into maggots and flies and rats. And so he placed garbage outdoors, covered it over with a screen, and of course the flies were not able to get to the garbage or the rats, and he verified it's not possible for non-life to become life. Well, the evolutionary assumption is that it did happen a long time ago in the distant, unobservable past. The idea that non-living materials can assemble to become life has been accepted by the intellectual community that support evolution. And of course, one of the experiments that's commonly referred to is the Stanley Miller experiment. It goes back to the 1950s. And many people today still argue, it's possible in the laboratory, given the right conditions, to produce building blocks of life. And this is what Miller did. He had an apparatus, which included boiling water. He created an oxygen-free environment. Methane was added, hydrogen was added, ammonium hydroxide, and then a 50,000-volt spark. There was a cooling chamber and a trap. And yes, he was able to produce some building blocks. Amino acids, glycine, alanine, aspartic, and glutamic acid. There were non-biological amino acids. Urea, organic acids, formic, acetic, succinic, and lactic. But there were problems. You see, this was an oxygen-free environment, and that would have been totally unrealistic in the original Earth if life originated from non-life. And of course, there would be no trap present when life was formed. there was the production of these toxic chemicals, which would have destroyed any of these building blocks that supposedly were created spontaneously. And left-handed amino acids are the only ones that are required for life when in this particular situation both left-handed and right-handed amino acids were produced. And today, most scientists don't refer to Miller's experiment as verification of the proof that non-life can become life. For example, Hubert Yockey, in a paper called A Calculation of the Probability of Spontaneous Biogenesis by Information Theory, from the Journal of Theoretical Biology, volume 67, page 396, stated the following. The warm little pond scenario was invented ad hoc to serve as a materialistic reductionist explanation of the origin of life. It is unsupported by any other evidence, and it will remain ad hoc until such evidence is found. One must conclude that, contrary to the established and current wisdom, a scenario describing the genesis of life on Earth by chance and natural causes, which can be accepted on the basis of fact and not faith, has not yet been written. It couldn't be clearer. In other words, what Yockey is saying, it has never been observed that non-living materials can spontaneously formulate life. Nevertheless, we continue to see this propaganda proclaimed. For example, the National Geographic, March 1998, page 60. There is an article about Stanley Miller's experiment, father of prebiotic chemistry, and this statement. Approximating conditions on the early Earth in a 1952 experiment, Stanley Miller, now at the University of California at San Diego, produced amino acids. Once you get the equipment together, it's very simple, he says. Well, what are they talking about? A building block, they're talking about an amino acid, which is a component of a protein. Now, scientists have attempted to look at the possibility of proteins formulating spontaneously from amino acids at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And through statistical analysis, they came to the conclusion that the possibility of a protein molecule being formulated by chance would be 1 over 10 followed by 56 zeros. Now, that's an extremely small possibility. How small? Well, this is the analogy which they gave. They said it would be like walking down the street one day and seeing a lottery ticket on the sidewalk, picking up the lottery ticket and discovering that you had won the lottery for that week. But you would also have to do it the second week in a row. And the third week in a row, you would also have to find a lottery ticket and the winning one the fourth week in a row, the fifth week in a row. In fact, every week in a row, continuously for 1,000 years. That's the possibility of a protein molecule coming into existence by chance. A protein molecule is a building block of a cell. You see, there isn't a chance that it could have happened. This idea that molecules can become cells is nothing more than science fiction. There are no facts to support it. Another fact of biology is that life must come from pre-existing life. It's called the law of biology. When I was a student, when I taught biology, we taught this law. No one has ever observed life coming from non-life. But the evolutionary assumption is that it had to have happened in the past. All life that we've ever observed comes from life which already exists. Nobody's ever seen anything different. Dogs have puppies. Cats have kittens. And that's how life perpetuates. Now, there's another important principle that we can observe, that within the life cycles of the things that we see what we call kinds of life that show the appearance of variation. Variation which occurs within genetic boundaries horizontally. And a good example would be the dog kind. There are many different varieties of dogs, but they're all dogs. From Chihuahuas to St. Bernard. Now, If evolution is true, we should find some sequence showing something becoming a dog and a dog changing to become something else. That's not the case. We see variation within genetic boundaries, and that variation is horizontal, not vertical. For example, this chart taken from John Morris's book, The Young Earth, shows the variation within the humankind. There are over 6 billion of us, and we all are different, but all humans. The variation within the dog kind, the frog kind, the horse kind, and, of course, various kinds of plants. That's what we observe. And by the way, that's what Charles Darwin observed. You see, evolution is based upon one important fact, and that is the idea that through time there are changes that do occur, but these changes, as we observe, are horizontal. Charles Darwin, often called the father of evolution, he was one of the individuals who contributed to the concept. In some of our later seminars, we will present other founding fathers of the evolutionary idea, and I will show you there are numerous others. But Darwin observed in the Galapagos variation within genetic boundaries. He saw that there were numbers of different kinds of finches, different beaks, actually finches with different beaks, some short, some long, some medium. And he said, look at this, there's a variation of beaks within the finches. So this was the basis of his whole theory, that through time, gradual change occurs. Well, that does happen. But as we're going to see, the gradual change that occurs is horizontally. Now, here is a picture of Charles Darwin in the Darwin Museum in Moscow. And in the introduction, it was mentioned that I have had the opportunity to travel in Russia in various places and speak with various groups of scientists and educators. As you can understand, for many years, the former Soviet Union was based on an atheistic worldview, which was based on Darwinism. And the whole concept of evolution was foundational to that atheistic belief. Here in the Darwin Museum, I will show you one of the examples that is presented to show that evolution is true. There we have a series of beetles with different color variation. And they say, this shows that change can occur gradually through time. Well, yes, but these beetles are beetles. They remain beetles. They don't change to become something else. And that is exactly what we would expect from a biblical creation view. Now, another argument for evolution is the peppered moth. And we'll just go through this briefly. Before the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain, there were two kinds of moths, a dark variety and a light variety. And during the revolution, when the coal was burned and there was a lot of pollution, the bark of the trees darkened, and as a result, the light varieties was easily seen. This is the theory. Then the dark variety increased in population because it was protected because of the environment. And following the Industrial Revolution, when the pollution was cleaned up, then the lighter varieties supposedly increased. And so what does this show us? Well, first of all, there's research that has been done recently suggesting that some of the data that was collected to try to prove the peppered moth theory was somewhat tainted. But nevertheless, whatever the case, this is the argument. Before the Industrial Revolution, there were two varieties of the peppered moth, dark and light. Following the Industrial Revolution and the cleaning up of the pollution, there were two varieties, dark and light. And one kind did not change into another. The population changed, but we don't see a change taking place from one kind to another. So this whole idea has been used really as some of the basis of the evolutionary assumption. But creationists believe that natural selection occurs. In fact, it's a fact of nature. But natural selection does not change one kind of life into another. It only preserves the best that's suited. The environment provides the factors that assist in selecting out the best suited for life, so that the perpetuation of life may occur rather than become extinct. You see, when it comes to this idea of the progression of life, the evolutionary assumption is that given time, once non-life evolved into the mother cell, that this cell then progressed and developed through all, became the mother of all life forms on the Darwinian tree of life. And so at the bottom of the chart, we see an amoeba. At the top of the chart, we see a man. And the belief is that over hundreds of millions of years of time, as these layers were supposedly laid down, life lived and died, and the progression occurred from simple to complex, and that's how we should find it in these geological layers. So as you can see, there's a vertical progression from the bottom to the top, from simple to complex. This is what the evolutionary assumption teaches. And here's the typical Darwinian tree of life. The amoeba at the bottom, the man at the top. But is this what Darwin observed? Absolutely not. What Darwin observed is change or variation that took place horizontally. And many people call this kind of change microevolution. But as you can see, we're talking about two different things. The variation of life that occurs horizontally does not verify the idea that life changed vertically from simple to complex. And this is what confuses many people. They say, well, I know evolution takes place because life changes. It changes horizontally within genetic boundaries. So, now we move on and we look at the next level of the progression of life, and that is from cell to multicellular. We've already looked at this idea that non-life cannot become life, but what about the suggestion that a cell can become a multicellular creature? Well, let's look at what has been proposed. Here's an example of an article called The Cambrian Period, The Explosion of Life, taken from National Geographic, October 93, page 120. And here you see a couple of individuals, and they're in the Canadian Rockies in British Columbia, Canada, near Field, British Columbia. And as you can see, they're picking in the rock, and what they find there is very interesting. Let me read to you from the article, page 120. More than half a billion years ago, the world's first monster appeared. With bulging eyes and fearsome grasping claws, Amphipteryx cruised the seas during the geological period known as the Cambrian. Its mouth was a nightmare of hard plates and teeth, its body looking like a cross between a stingray and a lobster. It could grow 3 feet in length, giant for its time. For millions of years, animals have been simple, mostly anemone-like creatures or worms. Then, in a geological blink of about 10 million years, virtually all the phyla, or groupings based on body design of animals alive today, came into being. Perhaps encouraged by an increase of oxygen in the seas, this Cambrian explosion was the greatest burst of animal evolution the planet has ever known, and new fossil finds are highlighting its detail. Well, this is amazing. What are they telling us? They are telling us this. At the bottom of the geological chart, the Cambrian layer, one of the oldest supposed layers in Earth's history, there is a sudden appearance of complex creatures. And here are some of the examples. You see, all of a sudden, multicellular creatures appear. And many of these creatures, well, they look like something out of science fiction. Some of them have eyes, tentacles, complex organs. So now we have a great problem, you see, because in the Cambrian, which is supposed to be down at the bottom of the chart, one of the oldest layers, we have the appearance of these complex animals, and they have no intermediates that they can trace to show that single-cell creatures have evolved. Richard Dawkins, evolutionist. In fact, this man in Great Britain promotes evolution in a great way. In his book, The Blind Watchmaker, has made this statement. The Cambrian strata of rocks, that's what I'm talking about, the rocks that they were looking at there in Field, British Columbia, vintage about 600 million years ago, are the oldest, which we find of the major invertebrate groups, and we find many of them in an advanced state of evolution, the very first time they appear. It is though they were planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. You see, this is incredible. The facts tell us that in this supposed oldest layer in Earth's history, we have the sudden appearance of multicellular organisms, and as Dawkins said, it looks like they've been planted there. And he said, to the pleasure of creationists. Well, why would he say that? Because creationists believe that life came on the scene as a result of a creator. And, as we're going to see later, that it was destroyed, and that it's not found in any sequential evolutionary pattern. Amazing. And so that brings us to our second major point. There is no evidence that single-celled organisms have become multicellular organisms. No facts. These multicellular creatures are complex and they suddenly appear. Now let's move on. The next level on the way up the Darwinian tree of life, from multicellular creatures without backbones to multicellular creatures with backbones, for example, fish. This is another evolutionary assumption. But is there any evidence? Now, this is very important. If evolution is true, don't you think that there would be countless examples in museums showing this intermediate? You see, fish have backbones. We have backbones. So the evolutionary proclamation is that, you know, we're related to fish. So certainly there should be this link between creatures without backbones and backbones, and there must be examples in the fossil record that would be on display in the museums. And now I quote to you from The Fishes, Life Nature Library, page 60, F.D. Omni, who states, how this earliest chordate stock evolved, what stages of development it went through to eventually give rise to truly fish-like creatures, we do not know. Between the Cambrian, when it probably originated, and the Ordovician, when the first fossils of animals with really fish-like characteristics appeared, there is a gap of 100 million years, which we will probably never will be able to fill. You see, this isn't a creationist making this statement. This is someone who's in support of evolution. And he's simply saying this. Between multicellular creatures without backbones and multicellular creatures with backbones, there's a 100 million year gap and there's no evidence. And he says, probably we will never find the evidence. That's very significant. So now we have another problem. Not only do we not have any evidence that non-life can become life, there is no evidence that single-celled organisms can become multicellular. There's no evidence now that multicellular organisms without backbones can become multicellular creatures with backbones. So another major problem for the evolutionary worldview. There are no facts. Moving on, now from fish to amphibian. Again, this is a major assumption of the evolutionary model in the Darwinian tree of life. The belief is that through time, fish have evolved to become amphibious creatures. Well, how did that happen? What kind of evidence do we have? Well, I would like to refer to this book. It's called The Rise of Life, The First 3.5 Billion Years by John Reeder. This book I obtained at the Smithsonian Institute when we were there doing the documentary film that I mentioned earlier. And in the book, there are a number of artists' conceptions. Particularly the ones that I'm going to be showing you supposedly show how fish evolved into amphibian. And here's the first artist conception, and you will see at the bottom a fish. And notice what happens as the fish begins to rise up towards the top of the pond. You will notice that the fins change to become legs. Has this been observed? Well, again, what we have here is an artist's illustration. Let us look at another illustration from the same book. There we see a stream which appears to have dried up. And notice at the bottom of the stream, the edge of the water that remains, a fish-like creature with fins. And then notice what you see crawling up the side of the bank. Now you have an amphibious creature with legs. So it's amazing what can be done with artist illustration. But the point that we're trying to make is we need more than artwork in order to verify a theory. We need the fossils. We need facts. Well, people have said, well, we do have facts. Coelacanth, that was a missing link between fish and amphibians. Well, coelacanth is an interesting discovery. You see, it was believed to have been extinct for over 70 million years until in 1938, a coelacanth was caught live and well off the coast of Madagascar. Up until that time, the coelacanth had been used in order to try to date layers. And when they found a coelacanth, they knew that the layer had to be at least 70 million years old. It was called an index fossil. So as you can see, this would create a problem. Now they found a living coelacanth. That means, well, they're still alive. And the coelacanth was no longer used in order to date the layers of the earth. The coelacanth was a fish, not a link between fish and amphibian. R.L. Carroll from Vertebrate Paleontology and Evolution, again an evolutionist, makes this statement. No one can be certain which group or groups of fishes was the first to make the transition to land, or what their evolutionary pathways may have been. The transition from water to land occurred long ago, and various family trees suggested by the fossil record are so tangled that scientists acknowledge they may never be able to sort them out definitely. So now we have another problem for the evolutionary worldview. Although the claim is made that fish have evolved to become amphibians, as you can see, the evidence is very questionable. Now we move on to the next level of this evolutionary idea that life has evolved through time vertically. It is also believed that amphibians, through another channel, evolved to become reptiles. But again, we need to ask the question, what is the evidence? Well, there are numerous kinds of reptiles. We have turtles. We have serpents. There are various kinds of lizards and even flying reptiles. So there's quite a differentiation. And in fact, when we talk about the reptilian kind, we see some rather interesting creatures, crocodiles, alligators. And generally it's believed that the dinosaurs also fit into this category. So when we look at dinosaurs, one of the most fascinating subjects when it comes to the subject of fossils and the past, we see there are many, many different variations, and these creatures grow to tremendous sizes. Not all of them, but many did. And they're found all over the world. So how did they come into existence? According to evolution, by a process of gradual change evolving from the amphibians. Well, here's a book put out by Scientific American. As you can see, the title is called Evolution. And in this book, there are a number of charts. And I will show you this particular chart, which is supposed to show how amphibians evolved into reptilian creatures. And there at the top are the reptilian creatures. At the bottom, you see the common ancestor, the amphibian. But now you'll note, as I put up these question marks at the bottom of the chart, I'm placing the question marks where there are dotted lines. What does that mean? Well, that simply means there are no fossils in order to be able to tie the amphibians to the reptilian creatures at this level. But notice at the top, you see the appearance of all of these reptiles. But if there's no way to connect the dots, then how can we prove that amphibians have evolved into reptiles? The answer? We cannot. Carroll, in his book Vertebrate Paleontology and Evolution, page 198, an evolutionist, not a creationist, states, the early amniotes, that is reptiles, are sufficiently distinct from all Paleozoic amphibians that their specific ancestry has not been established. Now, this creates a further problem. This belief that amphibians have evolved to reptiles is not based on observable evidence. And yet, it continues to be presented. Now we move to another phase of the evolutionary tree, and that is the belief that reptiles have evolved to become birds. And again, we need to ask the question, is there evidence that this has occurred? This, again, is the Darwinian tree of life. And as you will see, on the tips of the branches, various kinds of life have been placed. We've already gone through the lower sequence, the idea that non-life can become life, no evidence. The idea that a single-cell organism can become a multicellular creature, no evidence. The idea that a multicellular creature without a backbone can become a multicellular creature with a backbone, like a fish, no evidence. There's the belief that fish have become amphibians, no evidence. Or that fish have become reptiles, no evidence. Now we look at this next thing. That is that reptiles evolved into birds. Well, surely there must be evidence. Well, as with these others that we've looked at, there are no intermediates. Now think of this. This should be an easy one to find an intermediate. If a reptile has evolved into a bird, well, obviously there are a lot of differences, but let's just look at one. Reptiles have legs, front legs. Birds have wings with feathers. So if evolution is true, shouldn't there be countless examples showing legs becoming wings? There are none. Never been found. Well, what about Archaeopteryx? This is another example of what they say is a missing link that has been discovered. Well, there's a lot of controversy over Archaeopteryx. They say it has reptilian characteristics and bird characteristics. Why do they say that? Well, it had teeth in its mouths and claws on its wings. But there are countless birds in the fossil record that have teeth in their mouths and they're birds. There are living birds today that have claws on their wings, and they're birds. So these two features shouldn't verify that Archaeopteryx was part reptile and part bird. Nevertheless, the theory continues. It must have occurred, the evolutionists say, that reptiles have become birds. And we often find illustrations showing how this occurred. Here, for example, is supposedly proto-Archaeopteryx. As you can see, he doesn't look very confident about flying. Here's another version of Archaeopteryx at a later stage with his wings spread out, ready to take off. And another illustration with Archaeopteryx in the air. You see, there's been a lot of debate over how birds evolved. And I find this particular debate very interesting. It's from a science yearbook, 1980, but it's still relevant. Let me quote. Regarding a debate over bird flight. Most paleontologists assumed that Archaeopteryx could fly, or at least to glide from tree to tree. They assumed that the bird's ancestors learned to climb trees to escape from predators and seek insect food. Once the bird was in the tree, feathers and wings evolved to aid in gliding from branch to branch. Paleontologist John H. Ostrom of Yale University in New Haven, Connecticut, reported in January 1979, however, that Archaeopteryx learned to fly from the ground up and not from the trees down. Carnivores ran along the ground chasing flying insects, which they nabbed with their teeth or their front legs. Longer feathers in the front legs evolved to act as an insect net, and so the legs became wings. Then they used the wings to make flying leaps after insects. Two different views. I like this particular illustration. Dr. Gary Parker, who is a good friend of mine, has this in one of his books, outlining these two views. You see, the one idea is that this proto-bird climbed up into the tree and needed to find a way to get down, so evolved wings to glide from branch to branch. But the other idea is, no, it didn't happen that way. Archaeopteryx, that is proto-Archaeopteryx, was running along the ground, chasing flying insects. And on one occasion, perhaps this flying insect was just hanging over the edge of a cliff, and Archaeopteryx took a leap after the insect, and wings had to evolve. But as you can understand, this is ludicrous. There's no evidence that wings have evolved. But for evolution to be true, that would have had to have been the case. Here's the dino bird. Every once in a while, we see discoveries presented in major journals or magazines like National Geographic. Now, who could deny this? On the front cover of National Geographic, there you see a primitive reptilian bird-like creature. Now, where was that discovered? Well, first of all, let me tell you, that's a model, not a fossil. And the feathers, of course, have been added. And the interesting thing about this, National Geographic did a major article, and it wasn't just a few months later, and it was found that the fossils that were used to formulate this dino bird were fraudulent. Well, actually what happened, they used two separate fossils, a reptile and a bird, and combined the two. Actually, they found the fossils were bought from a Chinese farmer. And this proved to be somewhat of an embarrassment to those that were involved. But what you see on the front of National Geographic is not true. But in National Geographic, this presentation, and you will see in the bottom left-hand corner, a dinosaur standing on a tree branch, and above that you see, well, he's already taken off with wings. Again, you can do amazing things with artwork. But this in no way verifies the evolutionary assumptions regarding what would have to occur for reptilian creatures to become birds. Well, National Geographic shows us the process that they say occurred by illustration. But think of what would have to happen. Scales would have to become feathers. There would have to be the formation of lighter bones for flight. Legs would have to become wings. The change from a snout to a beak, and then, of course, the change in the back feet. And there are many others. Changes that would have to occur for reptiles to become birds. You see, this creates another problem. And this whole idea that reptiles have evolved into birds, again, is based on very questionable evidence. There are no facts. Well, now we move to this other category, getting towards the end, and that is reptiles to mammals. Evolution believes this has occurred. Reptilian creatures, they say, through time have become mammalian. Now think of what would have to occur. Mammals have hair or fur. That would have to evolve from scales. Mammary glands for feeding appears in mammals. How did that occur? Mammals are warm-blooded. They require temperature regulation, increased locomotion, a diaphragm for breathing, and offspring are born alive. You see, it's easy to make the claim that reptiles evolved to mammals, but can you show the process how that occurred? It's impossible. And yet it's believed. Finally, a fetal circulation system, which I will discuss in another session. And back to that chart that we looked at earlier from the same book. We notice that at the bottom of the chart, there is absolutely nothing for a common ancestor. And again, you will see question mark after question mark. That's where the dotted lines are. But at the top of the chart, you will note all of the mammals are shown, supposedly related to reptiles. Based on what evidence? Absolutely none. The horse series. You will see this in almost every museum. That is, this idea that a rabbit-sized creature, through time, evolved to become the modern horse. I was in the Museum of Natural History in New York City, where they have these elaborate paintings and models showing how the evolutionary process occurred. And very few people will question this because, well, it's in a history museum. Surely they know what they're doing. But regarding horse evolution, let me quote to you a statement by Professor G.A. Kirkhute, Department of Physiology and Biochemistry from the University of Southampton, in an article called Implications of Evolution. And I quote, It would not be fitting in discussing the implications of evolution to leave the evolution of the horse out of the discussion. The evolution of the horse provides one of the keystones in teaching evolutionary doctrine, though the actual story depends to a large extent upon who is telling it and when this story is being told. In fact, one could easily discuss the evolution of the story of the evolution of the horse. So as you can see, this evolutionist is not convinced. The idea that reptiles have evolved into mammals, like all of the others that we've talked about previously, is not based on any evidence. Later in our series, we're going to be talking about this in an entire session. That is the idea that apes have evolved into humans. This is perhaps the most commonly taught principle, that our ancestors are brute ape-like creatures. And we will point out once more, there is absolutely no evidence. But for now, I want to quote to you from a book, Richard Leakey's Making of Mankind. As you may know, Richard Leakey, through the years, has been one of the major promoters of the evolutionary assumption, particularly in the relationship of ape-like creatures evolving into man. And from the introduction of Richard Leakey's book, this statement. He says, "I express concern about the growing support for creationism, because it has serious and far-reaching implications. If society legislates against the teaching of scientific truth on one issue, where will this process stop? A few people still hold to the belief that the earth is flat. Should they too have equal time in schools? The great achievements of modern science are gravely threatened by this insane development." Richard Leakey saying that if you question the evolutionary worldview and you belong to that creationist camp, you're insane. But I think that it can be demonstrated that the assumptions of evolution, based on what we've looked at here today, the idea that non-life can become life, no evidence. The idea that a single-celled organism can become a multicellular creature, no evidence. The idea that a multicellular creature without a backbone can become a multicellular creature with a backbone, no evidence. Or that fish can become amphibians, or that amphibians can become reptiles, or reptiles can become birds or mammals. There's no evidence. So to challenge that, does that categorize someone as insane? I don't think so. I think that many people have simply accepted what they've been taught and they haven't checked it out for themselves. And as we conclude, I want to refer to the Apostle Paul's warning. O Timothy, keep that which is committed to thy trust, avoiding profane and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so called, which some professing have erred concerning the faith. Grace be with thee. Amen. You see, the creation view is simple. God created life. And it came on the scene. All kinds of life in the beginning, in multiplied, perfected forms, with the ability to reproduce after its kind. There